Hi, this is Climate Challenge, a podcast by the International PhD College of the University of Bologna on the social environmental crisis. Hello and welcome to our new podcast episode, How to Promote Pro-Environmental Behaviors. I'm Rosin Wu, a PhD student in economics, and I'm also one of the International PhD College in the Collegio Superio at the University of Bologna. I am your host in this episode. In previous episodes, we already discussed a lot of consequences caused by the climate change. Therefore, in this episode, we are exploring how behavioral changes, both individually and societally, are crucial alongside technological and economic solutions to meet the challenge of ecological transition. We are very happy to have with us two experts in the field of environmental conservation, who will share their insights, experiences, and inspirations. Today, we are joined by Professor Alessandro Tafoni. He is a professor of environmental economics at the Department of Economics at the University of Bologna. He has published in journals such as Science, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and in top field journals such as Journal of Environmental Economics and Management and Nature Climate Change. His research focuses on overcoming behavior and political economic barriers to cooperation in the climate commons. Currently, he also is a principal investigator of green tipping, which is a five-year ERC consolidator grant that investigates the effectiveness of social tipping innovations to scale up climate cooperation by using game theory as well as lab, online, and field experiments. Thank you for joining us today, Professor Tafoni.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
We're thrilled to have you with us. To kick things off, could you share a bit about your journey in the field of environmental economics? What initially drew you to this area of research?
I've always been interested and fascinated by issues that are somewhat at the intersection of economics, psychology, and environmental issues. This is simply a reflection of my personal interest in human dynamics and fundamental issues such as that of cooperation, what brings people together, and at the same time realizing, you know, the increasingly pressing needs to do something about scaling up climate action and in general about tackling the environmental problems that we are causing on this planet. So in a way, this sort of natural inclination to study the behavioral, psychological aspects of human behavior with a view to the consequences for the environment took me to economics, which, you know, maybe it's not such a straightforward choice, but in the end, what is economics if not decision-making on a finite planet about issues that are very much important at different scales, both individual. That led me to study economics as an undergraduate, but at the same time, I was, you know, a little bit, I wouldn't say frustrated, but certainly I felt that mainstream economics doesn't necessarily capture important aspects at both scales. I wanted to go deeper in the behavioral processes, and so during my PhD, I started to get deeper into the behavioral economics side of the picture and to try and see the implications for environmental cooperation. So this somehow took me to do a thesis on this sort of interface between these two fields. And pretty much I've continued to work on this since then, first as a postdoc in London at LSE, where I ended up staying some 9 years. And then more recently, although it has been now almost 4 years, I moved to Bologna University at the economics department. So this is a bit my journey so far.
It really highlights the passion and commitment needed in this field. To start our formal discussion, let's discuss why technological solutions and economics decisions alone are not enough to drive an ecological transition, which aspects they cannot address very well.
Okay, I would say that we need both. Typically, economics tends to focus much, or in general, academia, I would say, tend to focus much on the supply side of climate policy and environmental action, namely carbon taxation, emission trading systems, subsidies, policies that, you know, that are introduced to correct externalities. Now, we all know the importance of externalities, and clearly climate change can be seen as arguably the biggest externality man has ever seen and created, and is now asked to find a solution about. But, you know, the risk, if you only focus on technology and supply side, the risk is that you may be missing important issues on the demand side, which is why I think complementary, sort of a more holistic approach would try and also address these. And don't get me wrong, I don't mean to say that, you know, individual action is the solution to big problems such as climate change. There is no way that even if we all collectively, individually, do our best in terms of limiting our footprint, would be able to solve the problem that's now so urgent. So we need both. We need technology, we need innovation, we need investment on the supply side. But given that we are, you know, the window of opportunity for closing down the gap between our trajectory and the goal of the Paris Agreement of staying within 2 degrees Celsius warming, ideally at less than 1.5 Celsius warming, is closing rapidly. So it is no longer reasonable to think that traditional policies would deliver. So we need very much climate action also at the individual level as a complement. And there's a lot of low-hanging fruits, and there are still opportunities to be taken. So I think we need more research on this side of the picture.
Thank you. I get that point. So where governments have been focusing on the supply side through things like carbon taxes and technology development, we are saying that there is a huge untapped potential on the demand side with individual action. Achieving that supply and demand balance is the key.
Yeah, it's also an important interaction. When you think about governments and, or even large firms, in the end, they are run by individuals. Yes. So policies that change our behavior individually may have important repercussions at the higher scale, and vice versa, right? So we are embedded in societies and in institutions. So I think it's ideally we find better ways of trying to understand also the linkages between these two scales.
Exactly. It all connects. It's not just top-down or bottom-up, but a feedback loop. Since our listeners might not be as familiar with the details, could you give us a brief introduction to behavioral economics and its role in promoting this kind of eco-friendly shift in society?
Again, I don't think I will do justice to these intricate concepts. And so for those of you who are knowledgeable about behavioral economics, you will find this a little bit shallow. But if I were to summarize what you know, the traditional neoclassical approach in economics has been vis-a-vis the promise of behavioral economics, the modern economics, as we are typically taught as students, including myself, tends to, you know, make simplifying assumptions for reasons of analytical tractability and elegance of the theory about human behavior. Typically, we assume that individuals are rational and somehow can foresee the implications of their own actions and those of others. Now, in recent decades, we have had increasing evidence, thanks to this relatively new field of behavioral economics, that oftentimes such assumption is too demanding, and we are not so rational as we like to think, or as the standard model would predict. There's an interesting stream of research that has led to people like Daniel Kahneman, who was awarded a Nobel Prize in economics and unfortunately recently passed, who have demonstrated that we predictably drift away from these rationality prescriptions. And so we've come to think about behavioral biases, right? And this sort of ways in which our behavior can be somewhat predictably reconciled with a more sophisticated theory. So behavioral economics does that. It tries to embed individuals in a more realistic context and by looking at traditional or important aspects that take us astray with respect to the predictions of the standard model, which we now know, thanks to laboratory and field experiments, that often tend to do relatively poorly in terms of predictive power. So, for instance, just to make this a little bit more concrete, we display patterns that are somewhat similar. Of course, you know, there's heterogeneity across individuals and across societies, but most of us tend to be averse to inequality to some degree. We tend to be averse to losses. That's a phenomenon known as loss aversion, again, due to Kahneman and his colleague Tversky. In fact, you can even estimate these parameters, and there are some commonalities among many of us. Another important aspect that is now clear is that most of us tend to be conditional cooperators. So you do things, you're willing to do your part, but insofar as you're relatively convinced that others are willing to also engage in the same effort or in a similar effort. Why do I care about this from an environmental point of view? Because clearly, that opens up the stage for other considerations that wouldn't be captured by a model where we simply maximize our own utility in a selfish manner, disregarding what others do. We are actually social animals, and we tend to care about what others do and what happens to others. And so if you put two important human traits together, that of being conditionally cooperative and with respect to climate change, the fact that we tend to hold a pessimistic belief about the willingness of others to take action. Now, if you put these two things together, then you'd logically assume that we, you know, many of us would be willing to do more. However, we tend to not act as much as we could because of this pessimistic belief. Psychology or social psychology, this is known as pluralistic ignorance. So we collectively underestimate the willingness of others to act. So that's why I think, you know, this is an interesting area of study, because you can actually do interventions, right? Mm-hmm. You as a policymaker, as a researcher, in order to change beliefs. And this is relatively inexpensive with information provision experiments, and it may have disproportionate implications, right? Because you may be able to induce people to act when they wouldn't be otherwise because they hold this pessimistic belief.
Thanks. That explanation was very helpful. It really clarifies where traditional economics might fall short and highlights the growing importance of the behavioral approach. Now, to make it even more concrete for our listeners, could you share one simple, successful example of how behavioral economics has driven greener behaviors and promoted ecological transition?
Now, when you talk about greener transition, of course, you know, this is assuming that the scale of change is so big that it makes a dent at the global level. I guess that's how I take it. And that seems to be, you know, very demanding. But there's evidence that nudges and relatively cheap interventions can have sizable effect. I don't know if that can be considered something that promotes greener transition. But for instance, a very successful tool is using defaults. Now, both in psychology and in economics, there's ample evidence about the power of defaults. So we, among the many traits that make ourselves save time, and we typically use as shortcuts to do things, is this idea that we tend to stick with the status quo, right? And so if you default people, say, at the cafeteria for students, into the vegan or vegetarian option, chances are, you know, most will stick to the status quo. You could still opt out. So in principle, you're not changing, you're not reducing or constraining the choice set in a way that is too paternalistic. But people simply because, or you highlight, so that's not necessarily defaulting, but giving prominence to the vegetarian option in a cafeteria is something that has been quite effective. Mm-hmm. Another second and last example, this more on the energy use side of the picture. There's been a lot of positive findings in using social comparisons as a way to stimulate people to conserve energy. I don't know about your utility at home, but most utilities now, for instance, in Italy, but this is global now. And in fact, the first studies were done, or the first big studies, I'm thinking about O-Power in the US, were done in the United States. And the idea is when people get their bill, they don't just see the kilowatt hours that they consume, but there's a comparison with their peers, meaning their neighbors, similar size in terms of household. Oftentimes, so that's the comparison part, the information provision part. But to make this extra effective, the intervention typically has some kind of normative judgment. For instance, in the O-Power randomized controlled trial, what they did is, which is has been used elsewhere, including here in Italy, is to add a smiley face if you use less energy than comparable neighbors, or a frowny face if you use up more energy than they do. So in a way, this normative judgment reinforces the idea that you should try to minimize energy consumption, and this typically has a significant effect. Not massive, but it's also a very cheap intervention.
Those were very good examples. The power of deep thoughts in the cafeteria and the social comparisons in energy use really show how behavioral economics can be applied in practical local ways. Speaking of practical applications, I'm very curious about your current research in the green tipping project. Could you tell us more about what green tipping actually means?
This is the topic of this ERC Consolidator grant that you mentioned earlier, which I've recently started here at the Department of Economics in Bologna. It's a five-year project. Why is it called green tipping? So this is going to be familiar, I think, given what we have talked about so far, which is not a coincidence. The idea comes from so-called social tipping interventions. So let me step back for a second. This is, I guess, a multidisciplinary audience. So maybe some of the people listening to your podcasts are more on the natural science end of the spectrum, perhaps. If so, or even if they are social scientists or whatever the field of study is, when we talk about tipping, oftentimes the focus goes to natural tipping points. So ecological thresholds that could trigger irreversible change. Typically, this is a negative thing of a disastrous kind, right? If you think about the collapse of the Arctic ice sheet or some kind of ecological tipping points, including unmitigated climate change above a given level of warming, it can be considered as a tipping point. Now, so that's sort of the where the literature has spent most of the time in the past. More recently, there's been, partly because we are realizing that window of opportunity is closing fast. So scientists have been trying to think about ways to accelerate change. And so borrowing this idea of irreversible change in ecological systems, the idea is to see whether a similar pattern could happen at a societal level. So that's the social tipping point idea, that if you get enough people to commit to a given behavior or change this, even if this is a minority effort, it may be enough to induce others to follow suit, eventually taking over the majority of people. In fact, there's some early laboratory and online work that suggests the so-called magic number of 25%. Namely, that if you have a committed minority of, say, a quarter of the population that are very committed to this new behavior, whether it is to cease smoking or attitudes about same-sex marriage. So this needs not be environmental, but it could be about a revolution even, right? If you have enough committed individuals, they will, so the early adopters, if you think about technologies or behaviors, beyond a given threshold, the tipping point, 25% in this example, then people that have a threshold or are less keen on the innovation, maybe they're a bit more conservative, might be induced to follow suit. And this could trigger a cascading effect. So building on this idea, then the hope of this very new literature is to study and ideally find ways to induce social tipping of the good kind, right? So switch towards more sustainable behaviors. And now, you know, this is largely an empirical matter because we have to see, it depends on which kind of behavior or action we have in mind. But this is the basic concepts behind the theory that was developed actually earlier in both in economics and in sociology. People like Schelling in economics or Granovetter in sociology studied threshold models that had this idea that the more the adoption, the easier it is to switch. And you can apply these kind of models to, you know, choice of, say, an electric vehicle over an incumbent dominant fossil fuel engine type of choice, or, you know, choosing a low carbon lifestyle. And so that's the idea of social tipping interventions. Can you actually engineer or facilitate change so that you reach that threshold after which behavior continues to change spontaneously? That's the idea of social tipping interventions, and I call it green tipping because it's about environmental behavior.
Yeah. It's so new and cross-disciplinary. Taking these concepts from natural science and applying them to how our societies behave. It's a very cool idea, but there is also growing evidence, like people often underestimate other people's concern about climate change. Why do you think this is the case, and how does that affect social tipping?
In a way, we've already touched on this, so I'll be extra brief. When we talked about pluralistic ignorance, which is a typical problem in climate change, pluralistic ignorance, this idea that we tend to underestimate what others are willing to do. And so that's part of the idea behind this project. One of the goals experimentally of the Green Tipping Project is to study whether such beliefs, pessimistic beliefs, can be changed if you, for instance, provide information about the behavior of others. So imagine that you do like a large-scale elicitation at the national level. So you have a representative sample of people and you estimate what the beliefs are about climate change, but also people's willingness to act. And then you feed that information to another cohort of people of the same country, for instance. You may be able to trigger higher willingness, for instance, to donate to a climate charity or to sign a petition in order to pledge the government to take stronger action simply by doing this kind of information provision experiment. So I think, you know, this is a problem. Climate change is problematic, as we know, because of some features that make it particularly difficult to cope with, the fact that it is a global public good or public bad with, you know, unpriced externalities, and the fact that there is a time element such that the consequences of our actions are felt into the future, and also a scale issue, right? So emissions, you know, make the problem more severe independent of the point, the source of emission. So all of these make it a very difficult problem to tackle. But perhaps, you know, this is a promising avenue to explore. Correcting these misperceptions and doing information provision may be one channel in order to stimulate more action, individual action.
Let's hope we can overcome that underestimation and unlock the power of individual action.
Yeah, but again, you can help people, you as a policymaker or a government or an experimenter. So there are things that can be done, and information is... provision is not free, but it's cheaper than, say, a subsidy to a new technology. And we're using plenty of subsidies, both in Europe and in the US. So this is something that hasn't been tried out at a large scale, at least.
Yeah. So it sounds like there are tangible steps policymakers can take to get this right. In addition to this, we are very curious about how such a green tipping can apply to the pro-environmental behaviors. Also, we are interested in how the widespread neo-positive behavior must be before it's embraced even by skeptics. It's a bit tough issue as well.
Certainly, I would say if we continue with that example of pessimistic beliefs, related studies, for instance, in the US, you know, I'm simplifying here, but let's just say that in the US, people that vote for the Democratic Party typically are less likely to be skeptical, or at least are more convinced about the severity of climate change than Republicans. And when they did information provision of this kind that I mentioned before, so informing people that their fellow citizens actually do more than what most people think is the average, what is interesting is that, yes, of course, Democrats tend to donate more to climate charities. Mm-hmm. If you give them money and you say, how much of these $300 do you want to donate to offset emissions? Democrats typically donate more. But the effect of information provision, if I remember correctly, was higher among Republicans, simply because, you know, maybe the degree of the gap between the actual number of others who are willing to take action and what was perceived by Republicans was very large, larger than for Democrats who somehow internalized this. And so the increase in terms of donation was largest for Republicans. So that's positive news in a way, in the sense that, you know, people that may not be on board, you know, you could have a relatively large effect with these treatments. But your question, you know, how large needs to be the population of early adopters, or conversely, if there are, you know, 60% skeptics, can this population be invaded? I think it's very much context dependent. That's also why in the project I want to study different behaviors ranging from, as I said, petition behavior, like willingness to lobby for systemic action, or more individual behavior, like willingness to actually donate in order to offset your own emissions, but also actual behavior such as buying renewable energy contracts as opposed to standard energy tariffs that are typically cheaper. So it's likely that there's heterogeneity in these different behaviors and among people. And this can be studied also like by trying to cluster people in different bins and see, you know, who are the most susceptible to intervention and who are the least. So this is very important information also from a practical and policy standpoint.
Thank you for the breakdown. This was a really comprehensive answer. It sounds like the context is the key thing, especially early adopters. Also, the green tipping relies on a lot of things such as political party. Okay, now is the time for interaction. We also invited another speaker to join us in the next episode. And he is Dr. Simon Fang, a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Oxford. He is also very curious about your research project, and he has raised a few questions and hopes to hear your insights. He would like to know, what do you see as the key opportunities and the challenge currently in keeping toward environmentally sustainable society?
On this, I would say the main issue is time. I think we will eventually get there, meaning like have a majority of people that behave in a sustainable manner, and hopefully the same goes for governments and firms. But I'm less optimistic about the timing, right? Given that, as I said, you know, it's now a matter of years, you know, no longer decades, in order to try and close the gap and avoid, you know, going over the concentration in terms of parts per million CO2 equivalent that would lead to potentially disasters and irreversible climate change. So on that, I think this is both the promise and the peril of this framework of tipping. In a way, it promises to deliver fast, self-sustained, accelerating change. If we look methodologically, scientifically, and this has been pointed out by scholars, you know, this is not just me talking, but one concern is that people sort of project their wants, their hopes, while in reality, we only have very limited evidence so far about these social tipping processes. Again, mostly online, with online communities and laboratory subjects, typically students. In terms of external validity, we need to do a lot more, which is also the goal of the project, to try and lay out both the theoretical, but especially the foundations to test empirically, you know, what interventions may be more promising. So yeah, I think this is an interesting time, but plenty of challenges, because so far, you know, cooperation has been very modest, if you think about mm-hmm. what we have achieved.
Yes.
And to think that this can change quickly would be, I think, overly optimistic.
Yeah. So time is what matters the most. But we cannot do as much without this information, with these experiments. Overall, if that data becomes ready and reliable, do you think action can be made in this environment, like large-scale field experiments?
So for what concerns my project, my goal, yeah, I want to do an RCT, randomized controlled trial field experiment at the end. But I feel like first we need to understand better the theory and also sort of the micro behavior. That's why I think the lab and online experimentation are very useful. But yes, in terms of maximizing external validity, field experiments are particularly promising because, you know, it's a more natural environment. People actually make decisions that are, you know, not abstract, but consequential. So I think we need more of those, but it takes time, I think, to develop the infrastructure to get there.
Right. So it's a step-by-step process. Previously, you also mentioned that such idea is adopted from kind of natural science. So you have to prove such a theoretical model to prove that micro theory first in lab and online experiments, and then you can scale to do the field experiments. Another speaker has the second question. Why do we regularly observe opposition and backlash against the climate policies, and what can we do to prevent this?
I think this is down largely to fossil fuel subsidies, or put it differently, it's largely due to incumbency by fossil fuel, by actors that have stakes in fossil fuels. Or again, another way to talk about this issue is that of lobbying by special interest groups. So we have developed our economy over the last century or so in a way that is married inextricably with fossil fuel. I mean, if you look around everywhere, you know, the infrastructure we depend on is very much powered, actually physically built with oil. Oftentimes think about the role of plastic in our life. It's very difficult to move away from this equilibrium, right? So you can think about these processes as coordination, right? We are stuck in a coordination equilibrium. It just happens to be one that we thought was unproblematic, but that was largely due to the fact that we didn't understand or didn't want to see the negative externality and all the negative consequences of this way of developing the economy. And now the question is, how can we transition to a new equilibrium, which is sustainable and somewhat more embedded in on our planet's finite resources, and that can do away with dependence on fossil fuel, because this is clearly not sustainable. Given that for this long we have been thriving, because it shouldn't be understated, you know, all the good things that came out of our way of exploiting fossil fuels, right? We wouldn't be so wealthy on average, and we wouldn't have progressed technologically this far and this fast if it wasn't for fossil fuels. So now to reinvent, you know, an economy that doesn't pump CO2 into the atmosphere is something that is very difficult. And there's a lot of people that oppose this with all their efforts, right? And so fossil fuel lobbies clearly play a big factor. And so it's not just a challenge because it takes innovation and it takes new resources, but it's also a challenge because you have actors that are trying to slow down this process of change. So I think that is the biggest impediment.
Maybe we can also find a way, as you said, like coordination, also maybe kind of opportunity as well.
Yeah, sure. I mean, whenever you have a new market or a new equilibrium, there's opportunities for some. And now, for instance, you think about renewable sector, you know, some it's a mature sector, or at least, you know, think about wind and solar. And so this kind of economy is able to sustain itself even without subsidies in many parts of the world. But in order to get there, how do you transition? Initially, it's very costly, right? So you need policies again, and this will be try. There will be actors that will try to avoid that kind of change. And so it's a constant struggle. And we should always remind ourselves, as we speak, the amount of subsidies to the green economy are negligible compared to the amount of subsidies that fossil fuels still receive. So this is kind of an unfair battle. Mm. But still, we have to find a way out of this conundrum. But even if there will be opportunities, and people like Nicola Stern have argued that actually the cost in terms of GDP is not that high globally, but still, you know, there is a cost and there is a transition which can be painful, especially for certain sectors, right? And so that's the tricky bit, you know, finding ways to facilitate that transition.
Yeah, so it's this constant battle. But there is still such opportunity for new industries to be made to be more sustainable. It's interesting the other extreme, those environmentalist groups like Extinction Rebellion. What do you see is their role in promoting sustainable initiatives? So do you think they will have a net positive or net impact on climate action in society? Now we fly from this extreme to another extreme, and we are very also curious about your insights regarding this.
This is not grounded in any particular study. It's just my personal impression. Personally, I do think there is a value, especially, as I said, you know, we're now at the point where, you know, we're facing disaster and we're running out of time. Given that, again, as you speak, in this country, in the UK, where I've lived, fossil fuel subsidies outpace those to, say, the green alternatives, we need somehow to be reminded that we cannot sleepwalk into disaster, right? And I think this is the role of groups that try to wake us up in ways that, of course, are disruptive. But if governments tend to not pay enough attention, and if we have been perhaps pushed to think very much that if we do our little part and recycle, things will be okay, which is very much a narrative that has been somewhat pushed by, again, by fossil fuel lobbies trying to put the burden on us to take care of the problem at the same time, you know, pumping CO2 into the atmosphere, then maybe disruption is what we need. And we have examples in very close by in this country and the city where we live. So I think a movement like Extinction Rebellion is doing something that needs to be done. And so I'm not against that at all. And I think it's very easy to get into the routine, and you have your concerns, and time is limited. So sometimes disruption is important. Now, whether that is net positive, I would argue yes. But again, it's hard to, I mean, you have to measure also the costs imposed on societies. But without those costs, no one listens. Every year we have COPs, Conference of the Parties, where we agree on plans to do something, and CO2 concentrations keep rising. So clearly, incremental way of doing policy and doing business has not been helpful. So we need more radical ways, I think.
Yeah, I also think so. It's a very nice discussion today. And also, I found recently you published another paper in the Journal of Behavioral Economics and Management. Congratulations for this. Maybe in the following episodes, we also can talk more about such corporations and other related stuffs. Thank you very much for those insightful suggestions and for joining us today. It's clear that both individual actions and the collective society shifts are fundamental in driving the ecological transition. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. Remember, every small step contributes to a larger change. Continue to stay engaged, spread the word, and help us move towards a sustainable future. And join us next time. Goodbye. have been listening to Climate Challenge, a podcast by the International PhD College of the University of Bologna. You can find all episodes, all the references, and additional information on the college in the show description.